The Fan on Demand. It's Sunday morning with David Grossman, covering the biggest stories in high school, college, and university sports on Sportsnet Radio. The Fan 590.
Two minutes after 8 o'clock, Sportsnet Radio, The Fan 590. Sunday morning with David Grossman. Did I hear somebody say it was snowing yesterday? October the 2nd. It's been cold, and it still is, 5 degrees. But no snow yesterday, at least maybe northern Ontario, but not down here anyway. Today, the weather, not great. You need a shower, stand outside. It's going to rain. Tomorrow, rain. Tuesday, rain. That's all it is. On the radio show this morning, and a program note, yes, we're back to our two-hour format, and we've got lots of really interesting guests. George Gutaris is going to be joining us a little bit later on in the show. He grew up in Toronto. Now he's in the Major League Baseball playoffs with Milwaukee, who are up 1-0 after yesterday's 4-1 win over Arizona. Mike Benavides is going to join us as well. He played some football here in Toronto. Also was on a U.S. National College Championship team. And now he's coaching the defense for the BC Lions, which just happened to be the hottest team in the Canadian Football League. 6 consecutive wins. The last one in front of the largest crowd in the CFL this year. 50,000 plus in BC. And as I say, a lot more guests coming up. But we're going to start off with a sport that not many people think even existed at the University of Toronto. And we're talking about the sport of mountain biking. And last I looked, there weren't many mountains at the University of Toronto other than the one that students need to get over to get the degree. Today is race number 3 in a 4-race series, and a big one for John Winfield, who finished 8th in his first race a few weeks ago, and then 2nd in race number 2. And today, well, we're going to find out what his expectations are as he heads into a very critical race. He's joining us now on the phone. How you doing, John?
Hey, how's it going, David?
Very well, thank you. And thanks also for taking time to speak with us on what they call race day. Is weather an issue for you in this sport of mountain biking?
Yeah, it is. Today's fairly cold, so we're gonna want to make sure we dress really warmly, stay warm before the race, and maybe even wear some warmer clothes during the race.
Now, this is at Hardwood Hills, and I guess it's near where you live. But one would assume that the more clothes you wear, the more heavier you are. And is that something that's a bonus, or do you want to? When you ride, don't you want to have as few weight on you as possible?
Yeah, for sure. So a lot of the clothing that you would wear for warmer clothing is just more spandex. So it's pretty lightweight, but it'll just cover parts of your body that you wouldn't normally cover.
Give us an idea of the length of a race.
So the races depend on, they're different for the guys and the girls categories. And then there's also an expert and a more beginner category. And so the races range from about 15 to 30 kilometers.
We talk about peak performance, being a great athlete as well. We have to consider a couple of words called nutrition and diet. What does somebody like you eat before a race? Is it your usual breakfast or lunch, or do you tend to go a little bit light on the food and heavy on the water?
Yeah, usually the day before, usually try and eat a lot of food, a lot of carbs to really store a lot of energy. And then in the morning before a race, I'll just have usually like a bowl of cereal and some fruit about 3 hours before the race.
So you're not going to pork down a few cheeseburgers?
No, definitely not.
All right. As mentioned, you're from the Barrie area and Hardwood Hills. Have you gone through this course before? Do you know it quite well?
Yep. I actually raced this course last year and the year before when I was at University of Guelph. And I think it's the same course as the last couple of years. So,
can you explain the start for you this year? 8th place, then the last one, 2nd. Your expectations now for race number 3?
Yeah, so I was really happy with how the last races went. And today, because it's on the home course, I'm hoping definitely to be on the podium, top 3 today. So,
John Winfield is our guest. He's a mountain biker and a student at the University of Toronto. Now, David Wright is your head coach at U of T.
Yep.
Does a coach play a role in a mountain bike race? I mean, does he have any specific message that he gives you before a race? Or does he basically say, there's the bike, son, go ahead, go out there and do the best?
Yeah. Well, for people who have been racing a fairly long time, like myself, most of the pacing we kind of already know. But yeah, definitely for some of the other riders who haven't had as much experience, David will help explain, you know, how hard to go off the start, how hard to go on the first lap, where to, you know, make passes and stuff like that.
Now
when to take a bottle.
You're using a bike. Bike, last I looked, had tires, and there's air in tires. What happens if you get a flat tire on the course? What do you do?
Well, hopefully if you do get a flat, that you have a tube with you, a spare tube, and maybe a small pump on your frame or a little CO2 cartridge to pump that back up.
Has that ever happened to you before?
Yep.
So you're not automatically disqualified or throw the white flag up in the air. You just try to fix the problem and get back on the course.
As fast as you can, yep.
Now, not sure if they have any course marshals or if there are any such things as a video camera. I know they're not going to have a helicopter in a weather like today, but is it easy to go off course? And I'm not saying deliberately, but by accident. And even if you do go off course, how does anybody know?
So there are marshals out on the course, and they'll often take down your race plate numbers as they go. So if you miss a marshal station, then they would know that you've gone off the course. And they're usually fairly well marked with lots of signs and like flags. So,
what's the competition like?
It's a really, really a strong field in these races. There's a lot of the racers do the Ontario Cup Series in the summer, and some people even do national and international races.
A sport like mountain biking, I mean, I'm trying to see this in the big picture. At the University of Toronto, they have all kinds of sports. It's one of it is the largest university in the country. We talk about football or soccer or field hockey, but where does mountain biking fit in when it comes to popularity? How big a team do you have?
Well, it's actually on our forum, we have a registered member, so that includes everyone who's on the team now, any alumni who have been on the team. And last time I checked, there were 237 members.
Is there any assistance when it comes to funding, or is this more like a club? You pitch in, you spend your own, you get there on your own?
There is some funding. Like, we get our buses that go to the races and stuff like that. So, yeah.
You're not susceptible to being, maybe that's not the right word, but athletes can be tested by the Canadian Center for Ethics and Sport. As you know, there's a huge crackdown on, I guess, athletes who tend to go the other route. They tend to cheat or get away with it. Is mountain biking something that you're tested for? Could you be randomly tested by the CCES?
Yeah, you could be tested for sure.
And have you ever been tested?
No.
Okay. You're in your first year at the U of T.
Yep.
And you're a student in the Ontario, I think, Institute for Studies and Education. Is that right?
Yep.
Makes me think that you're going to be a teacher, right?
Yep, exactly.
Is competitive mountain bike racing something new for you, or is this something you started back in grade school?
Yeah, I've been doing it a long time. I started riding when I was about, like mountain biking, when I was about 9 or 10 years old with my dad and brothers. And I started racing just shortly after that, when I was maybe 11 or 12, actually at Hardwood Hills.
Not all schools have what they call mountain bike clubs. What's your feeling about this sport becoming maybe an OUA sport?
Yeah, like, I think that'd be great. The sport requires like a lot of dedication, and even though it is an individual sport, there's a lot of community and teamwork involved. Just in terms of the points for the schools, and everybody on the team always helps other people on the team, teaching new techniques, new skills, stuff like that.
Our first guest on Sunday morning is John Winfield, a student at the University of Toronto in the Ontario Institute for Studies and Education. And it's not football for him, or basketball or hockey, or for that matter, soccer. He chose mountain biking. He's already won a medal at university competitions. He's from Barrie, competing today at University Cup race number 3, which is at Hardwood Hills, basically around the corner from where he lives. These races, and for that matter, bikes as well, they can be kind of costly. Do you own your own bike, or do you have a couple of bikes that you take with you, or are they borrowed from the University of Toronto?
No, everyone on the team has their own bike. I have two bikes. I've got a mountain bike, which is the one I race on, and I also have a road bike that I use for training.
On the subject of training, what are we looking at? Is this something you do every day, or is it, I mean, do you spot it out twice, three times a week?
Probably about 5 or 6 days a week. Usually take one rest day.
Now, what do you call training? Is it like going around the block, or are you looking at intense training of about an hour a day?
It depends on the day. Usually, I do longer rides to build endurance, like especially in the off season, you know, 2 to 3 hour rides, longer rides. And then lots of intensity as well during the racing. So going out and maybe doing some intervals.
Has there ever been a time in a race where you've collided with another biker?
Yeah.
What happens?
It was actually at the Canada Cup this year at Hardwood Hills. I was going on a bridge, and another rider took it as well, and I don't think they had pre-rode and didn't realize that it was a narrow bridge, and so they actually ran into my rear wheel and sent both of us off the bridge.
Off the bridge?
Yeah.
You didn't get hurt?
Just gotten the wind knocked out of me. I was okay.
I'm looking at a race. I'm trying to picture this, a mountain bike race with hills, the terrain, probably in a day like today, a lot of mud over, some dry land. Is there a specialty for you? I mean, is it the start of the race? Is it midway through? Do you tend to do well, say, over hills or down into the peak valleys?
Yeah. I enjoy every course. I particularly like if there's some good long climbs. I tend to do well on courses with long climbs. Like last weekend at Bowler, for instance, it started and went up a ski hill, kind of all along that. And so the first maybe 4 or 5 minutes was uphill.
I'm trying to get an idea of the average bike. Are these things heavy, or are they fairly light that you can lift over your shoulder?
No, they're quite light.
And are there... go ahead.
Anywhere between maybe 21 and 26 pounds usually.
Are there opportunities, John, for you to take this activity or this sport further than what it is today, like races and events that maybe you can make some big dollars in mountain bike racing?
It is still pretty hard to make a lot of money doing mountain bike racing. There's more money in road racing still. But yeah, for sure. There's like different professional races you can do, even in Ontario, where you can win prize money. And even the Ontario Cups and Canada Cups in the summertime and springtime, you can win money if you get on the podium for an elite category.
Mountain bike racing, a series of four of them, race number 3 going today. What happens at the end of the fourth race? Is there a trophy, a championship? Do you move on to a national title?
Yeah, so we have an award ceremony, and there'll be an award for the person who has the most points in the series, so basically the most consistent rider throughout the four races. And as well, there's also a team trophy.
Where do you stand now after the first two races?
I'm not sure what place I'm in overall. I think maybe third or fourth.
Well, good luck.
Yeah, thank you.
It's going to be a tough race over rain and a lot of mud. And the distance again, how far?
It's going to be about 30K today.
30K. All the best to you. You got to be in tip-top shape for something like that. Thanks for your time, John, and good luck at race number 3. John Winfield. Wow, it's going to be quite a race over rain and mud in the Barrie area. He's from the University of Toronto, competing very soon in Hardwood Hills near Barrie. Race number 3 of a 4-part series. It's Sunday morning. My name is David Grossman. This is Sportsnet Radio, the Fan 590.
It's Sunday morning with David Grossman, covering the biggest stories in high school, college, and university sports on Sportsnet Radio, the Fan 590.
Two minutes after 8 o'clock, Sportsnet Radio, the Fan 590. Sunday morning with David Grossman. Did I hear somebody say it was snowing yesterday? October the 2nd. It's been cold, and it still is, 5 degrees. But no snow yesterday, at least maybe northern Ontario, but not down here anyway. Today the weather, not great. you need a shower, stand outside. It's going to rain tomorrow, rain Tuesday, rain. That's all it is. On the radio show this morning, and a program note, yes, we're back to our two-hour format, and we've got lots of really interesting guests. George Gutaris is going to be joining us a little bit later on in the show. We grew up in Toronto. Now he's in the Major League Baseball playoffs with Milwaukee, who are up 1-0 after yesterday's 4-1 win over Arizona. Mike Benavides is going to join us as well. He played some football here in Toronto. Also was on a U.S. National College Championship team. And now he's coaching the defense for the BC Lions, which just happened to be the hottest team in the Canadian Football League. 6 consecutive wins. The last one in front of the largest crowd in the CFL this year. 50,000 plus in BC. And as I say, a lot more guests coming up. But we're going to start off with a sport that not many people think even existed at the University of Toronto. And we're talking about the sport of mountain biking. And last I looked, there weren't many mountains at the University of Toronto other than the one that students need to get over to get the degree. Today is race number 3 in a 4-race series. And a big one for John Winfield, who finished 8th in his first race a few weeks ago. And then 2nd in race number 2. And today, well, we're going to find out what his expectations are as he heads into a very critical race. He's joining us now on the phone. How you doing, John?
Hey, how's it going, David?
Very well, thank you. And thanks also for taking time to speak with us on what they call race day. Is weather an issue for you in this sport of mountain biking?
Yeah, it is. Today's fairly cold, so we're going to want to make sure we dress really warmly. Stay warm before the race, and maybe even wear some warmer clothes during the race.
Now, this is at Hardwood Hills, and I guess it's near where you live. But one would assume that the more clothes you wear, the more heavier you are. And is that something that's a bonus, or do you want to? I guess when you ride, don't you want to have as few weight on you as possible?
Yeah, for sure. So a lot of the clothing that you would wear for warmer clothing is just more spandex. So it's pretty lightweight, but it'll just cover parts of your body that you wouldn't normally cover.
Give us an idea of the length of a race.
So the races depend on, they're different for the guys and the girls categories. And then there's also an expert and a more beginner category. And so the races range from about 15 to 30 kilometers.
We talk about peak performance, being a great athlete as well. We have to consider a couple of words called nutrition and diet. What does somebody like you eat before a race? Is it your usual breakfast or lunch, or do you tend to go a little bit light on the food and heavy on the water?
Yeah, usually the day before, usually try and eat a lot of food, a lot of carbs to really store a lot of energy. And then in the morning before a race, I'll just have usually like a bowl of cereal and some fruit about 3 hours before the race.
So you're not going to pork down a few cheeseburgers?
No, definitely not.
All right. As mentioned, you're from the Barrie area and Hardwood Hills. Have you gone through this course before? Do you know it quite well?
Yep. I actually raced this course last year and the year before when I was at University of Guelph. And I think it's the same course as the last couple of years. So,
can you explain the start for you this year? 8th place, then the last one, 2nd. Your expectations now for race number 3.
Yeah, so I was really happy with how the last races went. And today, because it's on the home course, I'm hoping definitely to be on the podium, top 3 today. So,
John Winfield is our guest. He's a mountain biker and a student at the University of Toronto. Now, David Wright is your head coach at U of T.
Yep.
Does a coach play a role in a mountain bike race? I mean, does he have any specific message that he gives you before a race? Or does he basically say, there's the bike, son, go ahead, go out there and do the best?
Yeah. Well, for people who have been racing a fairly long time, like myself, most of the pacing we kind of already know. But yeah, definitely for some of the other riders who haven't had as much experience, David will help explain, you know, how hard to go off the start, how hard to go on the first lap, where to, you know, make passes and stuff like that. When to take a bottle.
You're using a bike. Bike, last I looked, had tires, and there's air in tires. What happens if you get a flat tire on the course? What do you do?
Well, hopefully if you do get a flat, that you have a tube with you, a spare tube, and maybe a small pump on your frame or a little CO2 cartridge to pump that back up.
Has that ever happened to you before?
Yep.
So you're not automatically disqualified or throw the white flag up in the air. You just try to fix the problem and get back on the course.
As fast as you can, yep.
Now, not sure if they have any course marshals or if there are any such things as a video camera. I know they're not going to have a helicopter in a weather like today, but is it easy to go off course? And I'm not saying deliberately, but by accident. And even if you do go off course, how does anybody know?
Yeah, so there are marshals out on the course, and they'll often take down your race plate numbers as they go. So if you miss a marshal station, then they would know that you've gone off the course. And they're usually fairly well marked with lots of signs and like flags. So,
what's the competition like?
It's really a strong field in these races. There's a lot of the racers do the Ontario Cup Series in the summer. And some people even do national and international races.
A sport like mountain biking, I mean, I'm trying to see this in the big picture. At the University of Toronto, they have all kinds of sports. It's one of it is the largest university in the country. We talk about football or soccer or field hockey, but where does mountain biking fit in when it comes to popularity? How big a team do you have?
Well, it's actually on our forum, we have a registered member, so that includes everyone who's on the team now, any alumni who have been on the team. And last time I checked, there were 237 members.
Is there any assistance when it comes to funding, or is this more like a club? You pitch in, you spend your own, you get there on your own?
There is some funding. Like, we get our buses that go to the races and stuff like that. So, yeah.
You're not susceptible to being, maybe that's not the right word, but athletes can be tested by the Canadian Center for Ethics and Sport. As you know, there's a huge crackdown on, I guess, athletes who tend to go the other route. They tend to cheat or get away with it.
Yeah.
Is mountain biking something that you're tested for? Could you be randomly tested by the CCES?
Yeah, you could be tested for sure.
And have you ever been tested?
No.
Okay. You're in your first year at the U of T.
Yep.
And you're a student in the Ontario, I think, Institute for Studies and Education. Is that right?
Yep.
Makes me think that you're going to be a teacher, right?
Yep, exactly.
Is competitive mountain bike racing something new for you, or is this something you started back in grade school?
Yeah, I've been doing it a long time. I started riding when I was about, like mountain biking, when I was about 9 or 10 years old with my dad and brothers. And I started racing just shortly after that when I was maybe 11 or 12, actually at Harvard Hills.
Not all schools have what they call mountain bike clubs. What's your feeling about this sport becoming maybe an OUA sport?
Yeah, like I think that'd be great. The sport requires like a lot of dedication, and even though it is an individual sport, there's a lot of community and teamwork involved. Just in terms of the points for the schools, and everybody on the team always helps other people on the team, teaching new techniques, new skills, stuff like that.
Our first guest on Sunday morning is John Winfield, a student at the University of Toronto in the Ontario Institute for Studies and Education, and it's not football for him, or basketball, or hockey, or for that matter, soccer. He chose mountain biking. He's already won a medal at university competitions. He's from Barrie. Competing today at University Cup race number 3, which is at Hardwood Hills, basically around the corner from where he lives. These races, and for that matter, bikes as well, they can be kind of costly.
Yep.
Do you own your own bike, or do you have a couple of bikes that you take with you, or are they borrowed from the University of Toronto?
No, everyone on the team has their own bike. I have two bikes. I've got a mountain bike, which is the one I race on, and I also have a road bike that I use for training.
On the subject of training, what are we looking at? Is this something you do every day, or is it, I mean, do you spot it out twice, three times a week?
Probably about 5 or 6 days a week. Usually take one rest day.
Now, what do you call training? Is it like going around the block, or are you looking at intense training of about an hour a day?
It depends on the day. Usually I do longer rides to build endurance, like especially in the off season, you know, 2 to 3 hour rides, longer rides. And then lots of intensity as well during the racing. So going out and maybe doing some intervals.
Has there ever been a time in a race where you've collided with another biker?
Yeah.
What happens?
It was actually at the Canada Cup this year at Hardwood Hills. I was going on a bridge, and another rider took it as well, and I don't think they had pre-rode and didn't realize that it was a narrow bridge, and so they actually ran into my rear wheel and sent both of us off the bridge.
Off the bridge?
Yeah.
You didn't get hurt?
Just got the wind knocked out of me. I was okay.
I'm looking at a race. I'm trying to picture this, a mountain bike race with hills, the terrain, probably in a day like today, a lot of mud over, some dry land. Is there a specialty for you? I mean, is it the start of the race? Is it midway through? Do you tend to do well, say, over hills or down into the peak valleys?
Yeah. I enjoy every course. I particularly like if there's some good long climbs. I tend to do well on courses with long climbs. Like last weekend at Bowler, for instance, it started and went up a ski hill, kind of all along that. And so the first maybe 4 or 5 minutes was uphill.
I'm trying to get an idea of the average bike. Are these things heavy or are they fairly light that you can lift over your shoulder?
No, they're quite light.
And are anywhere there... Go ahead.
Anywhere between maybe 21 and 26 pounds usually.
Are there opportunities, John, for you to take this activity or this sport further than what it is today, like races and events that maybe you can make some big dollars in mountain bike racing?
It is still pretty hard to make a lot of money doing mountain bike racing. There's more money in road racing still. But yeah, for sure. There's like different professional races you can do, even in Ontario, where you can win prize money. And even the Ontario Cups and Canada Cups in the summertime and springtime, you can win money if you get on the podium for an elite category.
Mountain bike racing, a series of four of them, race number three going today. What happens at the end of the fourth race? Is there a trophy, a championship? Do you move on to a national title?
So we have an award ceremony, and there'll be an award for the person who has the most points in the series, so basically the most consistent rider throughout the four races. And as well, there's also a team trophy.
Where do you stand now after the first two races?
I'm not sure what place I'm in overall. I think maybe third or fourth.
Well, good luck.
Yeah, thank you.
It's going to be a tough race over rain and a lot of mud. And the distance again, how far?
It's going to be about 30K today.
30K. All the best to you. You got to be in tip-top shape for something like that. Thanks for your time, John,
yeah,
and good luck
at
race number three. John Winfield. Wow, it's going to be quite a race over rain and mud in the Barrie area. He's from the University of Toronto, competing very soon in Hardwood Hills near Barrie. Race number three of a four-part series. It's Sunday morning. My name is David Grossman. This is Sportsnet Radio, the Fan 590.
Like free sports tickets, trips, and memorabilia so you can trick your friends, colleagues, and mistresses into thinking that you're some sort of high roller? Hey, join the club.
Welcome to the club.
The Fan Club. Join online at fan590.com. It's time to hear about the superstars of tomorrow. It's Sunday morning with David Grossman on Sportsnet Radio. The Fan 590.
Sportsnet Radio, the Fan 590. It's Sunday morning with David Grossman, and it's the fall season, which means football. And joining us now, we're going to go across the country to British Columbia. And joining us is a Toronto native, now living on the West Coast. He's in his 12th season coaching in the Canadian Football League. Defensive coordinator Mike Benavides is on the line. Mike, it's been a long time since you and I have spoken, and I remember this guy who, I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt, was all muscle back then.
You're too kind.
Some guys on the line would say, no, it's chunkiness. But you were playing for the Central Tech Blues, a Midtown Toronto school. And your goal back then was to one day make it to the pros, and you did it, and you did a great job getting to the pros as a coach. But I'm wondering, any regrets at not actually suiting up as a player?
Really, I really don't. And when I look at it, David, I've been very fortunate to be in the CFL and be a professional coach for a long, long time. I've had a wonderful career thus far, and I've really enjoyed it. I'm one of the lucky ones. Not many people get to do it. So I've been really fortunate, and no regrets at all. I mean, I was fortunate to be around some great people and coaches like Bill Naylor and Chuck Wakefield there in Toronto in the school system, and they really pushed me to move forward, and they taught me a lot of things about discipline and perseverance, and here I am today, and I love it.
Now, you mentioned Chuck Wakefield. He played a bit in the Canadian Football League. Have you utilized any of what he may have showed you in today's game, or has it all changed and is more sophisticated now than when it was when you were a high school kid?
Certainly schematics and all that kind of thing has changed, but what Chuck was able to explain to me at an early part of my career and even when I played for him, it's just a game of tactical opportunity and where you got to extremely work hard and you always got to take advantage of the opportunity. So what he taught me was it's a real, real tough world and you got to make the best of the opportunity. So that really carried forward with me all the way through.
Now, there's always a price to pay. I'm sure your parents told you that. My parents said the same thing. A price to pay for something, and usually something that ends in success. And I'm not sure if you remember the summer of 2000, 11 years ago. You went home, and you said something to your lovely wife, Judy, who's a graduate of the University of Calgary. I think she got her MBA there, too.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
And you said something along the line of, dear or sweetheart, I've just been given a great opportunity. It means I'm going to have to travel a lot, work for about 12 hours a day, 7 days a week for about 8 months. And I think your wife said something like, that's wonderful. How much does it pay? And then your reaction was nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that?
Yeah, I absolutely remember that. That's a huge chapter in Judy and I's life, and I was really fortunate to have someone that's been so supportive along the way because it's not easy. I mean, this is a tough, tough business. It's long, long hours. You know, at that point, we were just newly married. We got married in May, and I had the opportunity to, and I was invited as a guest coach with the Calgary staff in that same May of 2000. So the support from her is, you can't put a price on it, and there's huge sacrifice. But, you know, as you said, at the end, it's all worth it, and all the lessons I learned along the way, and it certainly strengthened our relationship because it's definitely not easy going through all that. And now with a young family, so much of the burden is put on her, and she's a professor at Kuala Lumpur University. So she's got her hands full, and without her, I would be nothing.
One of your jobs, Mike, I think, is to scout Canadian talent so that you're ready for the upcoming draft. You happy with what you've been getting from Ontario?
You know, I really am, and I think what happens is it really becomes a situational and an opportunity thing. I'll use two examples. Jason Pottinger, who's now with the Argos, and I'll use Ricky Foley with the Argos as well. And your listeners probably are well aware of them because they play right there in Toronto. Those are two kids, one going to McMaster, one going to York. We drafted them in the first round in 2006. And that year, we went on to win the Grey Cup. So when you take a look at kids, for example, using Ricky and Jason, they are starters in the Canadian Football League. They're at the top of their game as Canadian starters. And, yeah, there's some great players coming out of Ontario, and really, it seems from the people I speak to that the system is quite vibrant, and there's even a lot, you know, there's Bantam football and all those kinds of things, which I was just talking to somebody yesterday. When I came up, my first opportunity to play contact football was grade 9 in high school, so yeah, there's some great players coming out of there.
Our guest this morning, Mike Benavides, defensive coach with the BC Lions. I hear of all kinds of stories from university coaches, Mike, that they have to reteach the fundamentals to graduating high school players. Do you find that the caliber or the quality of the high school athlete is as good now as it was?
When you talk about the athlete today coming out of high school and going on to university, the athletes are phenomenal. I mean, what these kids are doing at a younger age, be it a weight program, be it how they eat, be it how what their parents expose them to, the athlete today coming into a high school or out of a high school is far, far superior to where we were when I was in high school in the 70s and early 80s. When you look at it now, you know, there's great athletes then, but it's just they're finer tuned. They're more mature in their in their development from a physical point of view. So the athletes are outstanding. You still have to go through the fundamentals. We complain about that in the pros. It's no different because in college they just run them through and all that kind of stuff. But the athletes and the dedication of the programs are far better today than they were when I went to school.
When you won your first Grey Cup, it was with a member. You were a member of the Calgary Stampeders staff, and I assume you got that ring that you're still wearing. Do you show it off?
I do have that ring. I've been very fortunate, David. We won one in 2001 with Calgary in the Big O in Montreal. We also won one here with the BC Lions here in 2006. So I got two Grey Cup rings, which have a value which I can't put a price on, and I have one for each of my daughters, so I'm pretty happy.
Is it true that the Argos offered you the head coaching job before they went to Bart Andrus several years ago?
Yeah, that was exactly what occurred when all that went through, and you know, I was thrilled that they called Wally and asked me to go through the process of interview for a head coach. I was flattered, and obviously believed that I could go ahead and go through it and learn through the process. And it went really well. The people who were there were outstanding. The ownership was outstanding. And when it came down to it, fortunately for me, Coach Adam Reed at the time said that ownership wanted to offer me the job, and I was absolutely flattered. And after some time of thinking about it, I thought it was better that I stay where I am, but it was a great process for me, and the people with the Argos were phenomenal.
We're seeing more and more of the what they call the 3-4 defensive fronts in the NFL and the NCAA. Is there any reason why we're not seeing that in the CFL or the Canadian University Football League?
I think it's twofold. It's a very specific athlete. There's a lot of complicated situations that creates. So really, in our league, it becomes twofold. It really becomes about a down and distance issue and about the kind of athletes we have. And it just seems to lend itself that way. But really, everybody's playing that form in one way or another. We play that about 35% to 40% of the time, but we make it a second down special situation kind of thing. So there's more and more people using it situationally. In terms of a core basis, it doesn't happen very often. It's tough to get those athletes. They're all scooping them up.
In your playing days back at Central Tech, and then you went on to become a national champ as a player at Bakersfield College in California, would you ever consider coming back or coaching at the university level?
Well, a lot of times we've discussed it, and there's been various people who've spoken to me about it. You know, there is an interest because there is kind of a pure teaching aspect. You're looking at a season of 10 games or so. And I'm not going to say never, but right now dealing with the pro athlete and the pro game really, really suits what I love to do. But never say never.
In the off season, I mean, what does Mike Benavides do?
Basically, what ends up happening is it's a long haul, long marathon season. Usually December, we sort of tie loose ends up here. Personnel-wise, have some meeting and some exit interview, that type of stuff with the players. And then January, February is kind of get your wind back a little bit, get some rest, spend some time with family, that kind of stuff, because really they don't see you for about 190 days in a row. And then start recruiting, looking at the Canadian draft material, self-analysis, self-scouting, looking at our schemes and things that we're doing and what other people are doing across the league. So it's a real good time to evaluate where you're at, recharge a little bit, and start looking for new personnel.
You know, family means a lot, and it definitely means a lot to you. What's it like when Mike Benavides comes home after a football season, doesn't have a football in his hand or any paperwork, and has time to spend with the kids and the wife?
No, what I love to do is just to hang around with them, and it doesn't matter what we're doing. As long as I'm with them, I'm having fun. In terms of a personal way, I'd like to get a little bit of exercise in. Probably body's not in great shape after a long haul. And then if I could get a Cuban cigar and a motorcycle ride, because it's beautiful out here in the West Coast, even in the early parts of the year, that's what you'll find me doing.
Didn't start out too well season-wise for the BC Lions. As a matter of fact, you know, it can be rough for a guy coaching in the pros and a not-so-good start. Mm-hmm. Fans tend to get on you, and they get on you a lot. And you were once quoted as saying, if someone had 50,000 people watch what you do at work or 600,000 watching on television, there's going to be opinions, and they have a right to say what they want. But right now, everybody's angry. What we believe in is what we do, and I see the light at the end of the tunnel. You still feel that way?
I certainly do. I mean, people have a right to their opinion, and no question. I mean, we all are passionate about what we do, and, you know, I have opinions about other things that I watch sometimes. But it's one of those things where we love what we do, and we love the fans' passion. And at the end of the day, I said I see the light at the tunnel. And as you see right now, the club's turned around. We're at 6-6. We're going into the beautiful new BC place and playing there for the rest of the year. So absolutely, I'm happy where we're at, and certainly appreciate the passion of the fan.
But how difficult is it to hold back as a coach from saying really what you want to say and believe is true, knowing that there are people out there who could conceivably come after you like vultures?
It's okay. It's okay by me. I mean, we've been doing this long enough. We know it's a performance-based business. You know what you're getting into. And to be honest with you, it's kind of the fun part of it sometimes, because you really, you see that people really care about what you're doing. If you, you know, it's no different than being at Ivor Wynn, no different than being in Regina. When they're yelling at you and throwing beer cans at you, you know they're kind of passionate. So it's kind of the fun challenge of it, and we certainly understand where they're coming from.
Mike Benavides, there are people who think you may be the heir apparent when Wally Buono moves aside. Do you feel that you're ready for a head coaching job right now?
Well, to be honest with you, I don't know, David. What I'm looking at is looking at what we're doing right now, looking at the next game. And, you know, one day I think I'd like to try and do that. But I've already had the opportunity to do that, and I said no because I really love what I do right now as a coordinator and teaching the fundamentals and working with the group I'm working with. So I'm totally happy where I'm at right now. I'm not defined by any of those other things. And, you know, we got to maintain focus on what I have at hand. But one day, do I see it? Sure. But I don't see it anytime soon.
Any words to those football players at Central Tech?
Keep winning. You stick up for the blue pride and go get them.
Mike Benavides. Great. Thanks again, Michael, very, very much. All the best.
There it is, Mike Benavides, defensive coordinator with the BC Lions in his fourth season. And the Lions, well, they started out fairly slow, to put it mildly. And they've won the last six in a row, including a 33-24 win over the Edmonton Eskimos. That's right, six wins in a row, and before 50,213, largest crowd in the Canadian Football League. I remembered Benavides when he was a defensive lineman at Central Tech, and they had probably the best high school team in the city of Toronto in those days. And then he went on to Bakersfield College in California. They won a national championship. Very, very good football player. And I thought he would probably make it one day in the CFL, but he decided to go the route of coaching, and he's done that extremely well. If in case you missed it, in university football yesterday, Laurier knocks off Ottawa 57-16. York did get 23 points, but against a team that hasn't lost this year, Western. Western prevailed. Actually, York led 10-0, believe it or not, in London at homecoming. Final score, Western 48, York 23. McMaster knocks off Waterloo 46-20, and Windsor defeated Guelph 41-21. So right now, Western tops the OUA standings. Windsor and McMaster are tied with 4-1 records. Queens and Ottawa with 3-2. And then Laurier and Toronto tied with 2-3. Guelph and York 1-4, and Waterloo at the bottom. Laurier started the season winning the first two, losing the next three. And Queens, the reverse, lost the first two, won the next three. When we come back after a short break, we're going to talk to a woman who likes to walk and walk and walk. And she's improved her own Canadian record in that sport called race walking. That's coming up next. Rachel Seaman joins us. My name is David Grossman. This is Sportsnet Radio, The Fan 590.
It's time for the Dean of College Sports. It's Sunday morning with David Grossman on Sportsnet Radio, The Fan 590. Go like this. Tell me about the
tongue and I'll know you. Kiss me to your junk. Sunday morning on The Fan 590. Sportsnet Radio, it's a bit cold out there, 5 degrees. Maybe you can go for a walk, like a long walk, a real long walk, burn some calories. My name's David Grossman. Our next guest, originally from Peterborough, Ontario, a nice core of the community. No, not my wife. This guest is a race walker, and she improved on her own Canadian record for 20 kilometers. Try 1 hour, 33 minutes, 33 seconds, just about the kind of time it takes me to go down a Don Valley Parkway in this city during the day. Anyway, Rachel Seaman is joining us right now. She's the woman of the hour. How are you, Rachel?
Good, thanks.
I have to admit that when I watch athletes race walk, you know, with the hips gyrating and the legs marching like a soldier, my back starts to hurt. I mean, have you ever had people approach you and wonder, how do you maintain
that kind of walking for such a long period of time?
Yeah, I mean, every day when I'm training, pretty much I have comments and people are always saying, oh, like, that looks like that hurts a lot. And, you know, it really doesn't. And it's just, it's really natural, and it's actually less impact than running is. So it's not that weird, at least in my opinion. But
what about your,
weird.
What about your feet, though? I mean, do your feet tend to hurt?
No, like, you're really, because like with running, you're lifting up your whole body and you're carrying your whole body weight and coming down and, you know, and putting all that impact on your feet. Whereas with race walking, it's just really like a nice, smooth motion. And so your feet really don't hurt at all.
Do you have any tips for people who want to get into race walking? Like, is it good shoes? Do you need good shoes, or do you pump your arms, or how do you get in the groove?
Yeah, it's definitely, it's all about technique. And so you definitely want to be able to find somebody or look online and try to find, you know, some tips on how to do race walking, because for some, either basically you either pick it up right away or you need to work on it. And so you need to find out some, you know, what the proper technique is, because that's basically what race walking is all about, is technique. You can't go fast without good technique.
Always training, always competing. Are there times where maybe you just forget you're going out with your husband or friends and all of a sudden you start race walking instead of the usual walk?
I know people always think that you must be such a fast, normal walker when you're going out too. And my husband always says to me, oh, for the fastest walker in Canada, you walk so slow.
I believe your husband knows something about race walking as well.
Yeah, he's a two-time Olympian for the U.S., and so, yeah, he's been around in the event for a long time, and he also coaches me.
So he's the one that does the inspiration. Get out there, Rachel. Do your best. Rah,
yeah.
Rah, rah. All
yeah,
that
he
stuff.
Doesn't let me get lazy at all, definitely. He's out there with me every day, and so that helps a lot.
You did well, a championship at the Canadian Finals this past summer. And then you called your performance in South Korea, I believe it was the World Championships that you're at, in the sweltering heat, and I think you finished 37th, if I remember correctly, and you had collapsed on the turf and were carried off in a stretcher. You at that time, you called your performance a huge disappointment. What did you mean by that? Other than, I mean, is it always finishing top five? I mean, would an athlete not be happy that they've reached a world championship?
Well, I was definitely happy to be there, but I think because I was having such a successful season, I was going there with definitely higher expectations. But for me, a realistic goal was maybe coming top 20 or top 25. And so it doesn't look like my placing was that far off, but I was very disappointed with the performance, because I think that I could have maybe fixed some things leading up to it that would have, you know, maybe have a better performance. So I was sort of disappointed that having such a successful season, I just had such a poor showing, especially at the biggest race of the year. And so that was really definitely a little bit difficult for me to handle.
A lot of athletes like to bounce back. They need something. They need something to turn things around, a big hit of some sort. For you, it came in Germany. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened?
Yeah, I think that the Racing World Championships really fueled me to go after my last race of the season. And a lot of people say that to me, that when I have a really bad race, I tend to be able to really bounce back really well. And so I went there, and I knew that I could put everything into it because it was my last race of the season. And I was going for the Olympic A standard, which is 1:33.30, and I happened to miss it by 3 seconds. But I was still thrilled. I broke my Canadian record by another 10 seconds. And so, you know, it was a great way for me to finish the season.
Your goal is to make Canada's Olympic team for London next summer. You're about, I think, 3 seconds off the Olympic A standard. What do you need to do? I mean, what's the strategy for you now in order to make that team?
Well, I think that in my race in Germany, I did make a few racing mistakes. Like, I went out a little bit too fast for the first half. And so I really think I could have gotten the time there, but I think just moving forward in my next race next season, probably what I'll end up doing is just try to race a little bit more conservatively and just make sure I get that time, because I know I'm fully capable of it only being 3 seconds off, so that's very exciting for me.
Our guest, Rachel Seaman, who set the Canadian record in the 20-kilometer race walk, and I would imagine when you're out and about with friends, et cetera, they say, hey, Rachel, you've done very well for yourself in the sport. what was the best race ever? What one was it for you?
Well, I think one that sticks out in my mind is from when I was a junior. When I was 19, I won the Pan Am Race Walk Cup in Peru, and I set the junior Canadian record there, and I won the race, and that was definitely a huge high for me. And so I, hopefully in the future, I can repeat that type of performance at an international competition and medal somewhere.
Well, there was a movie back in the 60s called Walk, Don't Run, starring Cary Grant, about a fictional American race walker in the Summer Olympics in Tokyo. And the main character was someone hesitant to tell people that he was competing in race walking, since the sport was viewed at as somebody being a little bit nerdy. I don't see anything wrong with it at all. We wish you well, and I hope that dream comes true for you. We'll be cheering for you.
Thanks, I appreciate it.
Rachel Seaman, originally from Peterborough and now a Canadian champ. We're going to talk some baseball. We're going to go across the coast. Tom Robson's joining us right now. The Blue Jays may have done well, to some people, maybe not themselves for this season, but there's still lots of baseball playoffs coming up. And Baseball Canada announced the names of 24 players who are going to be participating in the national team's World Junior Qualification Camp in Boca Raton and also Miami, Florida. And that's in November. And one of those is, as I mentioned, Tom Robson, who the Jays signed. He's on the line with us right now. Tom, how you doing?
Good. How are you?
Very well. Congratulations, by the way, on your early success in baseball. From what I understand now, Canada is going to be competing in Colombia for the America's World Junior Qualifying Tournament. And we're going up against some pretty good baseball teams, the U.S., Cuba, Dominican Republic, all of them vying for four spots in the 2012 World Junior Baseball Championship in South Korea. How good is this Canadian baseball roster?
You know, I think we're pretty good. We've been practicing now for about a year. We had a trip in October. We had a trip in February, April, May, July. So we've been together for quite some time, and there's quite a few young guys on this year's team. Last year was mostly older guys, but we have a lot of young guys, just because next year we're going to need younger guys to compete in the world if we make it there.
Were you surprised that Baseball Canada picked you for the national roster, or did you think you had the inside edge knowing that the Toronto Blue Jays have you in mind for the future?
Yeah, well, when I was talking to pro scouts before the draft, I told them that I would want to play in this. I would want to compete in the World Qualifiers, so they already knew before that this is something I'd want to do. And obviously, the Blue Jays being from Canada, I think they respected my decisions and stuff, so it went over pretty smoothly with them.
Now, you're still a teenager, Tom. I mean, I can remember what those days were like. You're 18, right?
Yeah, I just turned 18.
It's what they call being young in the sports world, but sport is sport, and defeat is defeat. How does a youngster like you deal with a loss in a game, and what do you do to turn things around, or where do you go to for help?
Well, one thing I noticed that, you know, a lot of pitchers will do is they'll work so hard, and then they'll pitch, and they'll start, and then they won't do as well as they wanted to, and they'll kind of back off from all the working out and practicing and training and stuff. So one thing I try and do is stay on top of that, even know what the outcome of my pitching is, good or bad. I try and stay the same throughout the year. Always trying my hardest in the gym, doing what I should be doing, and making sure that when I step on a mound for my next day, I'm 100% prepared for it.
You're very fortunate, Tom Robson. I mean, you're one athlete who is way ahead of a lot of others your age. You're also somebody who is close to making it to the pros. For you, though, is that your biggest priority, making it to the professional ranks, being a professional baseball player, or do you see your priority right now playing for your country?
Well, right now, since I'm in Florida with the Blue Jays, I'd say it's the professional part of it. But once I go home, it will completely turn around, and I'll be representing my country, which is something I love to do. So it definitely will be trying to get my country into the world next year.
I see a lot of athletes, they get down on themselves very quickly. What gets you pumped? I mean, what is it that gets you out of that downer mood and into more of a let's go get 'em attitude?
Just the fact that you never know what's going to happen in baseball. There's so many games where you could be down by whatever, how many runs, and you can come back and win, just like the playoff race with Boston and Tampa Bay. Like, just, I can use that as an example, just because I think Boston was down like Tampa Bay was down like 9 or 10 games, and now they're playing Texas in the playoffs. So, you know, you never really know what's going to happen.
There's some young prospects that like all the attention, and others tend to struggle. Again, you're 18 years old. Is there also a period of intimidation for a guy like you where the pressure to perform and the constant scrutiny tends to get up your back?
No, I wouldn't say so. Just baseball is a game of failure, and I'm not afraid to fail. So when I'm pitching, I'm going out there to win, and you know, it's never in my mind I'm scared to lose or anything like that. I'm just trying my best to win and compete. So put my team in a spot where they can win the game.
Toronto Blue Jays pick Tom Robson joining us right now. You're a big boy, 6'4", 210 pounds. Your fastball is in the low 90s. I understand you got a good curve. You also have a changeup. I'm told you can hit the strike zone very well. What I don't know about, I'd like you to share with us, our listeners, is this two-seamer that tends to cut into the righties of the batters and away from the lefties. How hard have you worked at that?
This year is the first year I've thrown one, and I've been working pretty hard with it. Since I got down here in Florida, the Blue Jays pitching coaches are all huge on it. Obviously, we're all familiar with Roy Halladay. He has a really good one, and he started it here where I am. So all the pitchers here, we practice our two seams every day, and hopefully mine can become one just like Roy Halladay.
Getting picked by the Blue Jays, not many people, for that matter teenagers, get a call from Toronto Blue Jays general manager Alex Anthopoulos. What was it like, you know, when the call came through and he said, "Hi, is that Tom Robson? This is Alex."
Yeah, well, obviously when I got drafted, there was tons of emotions and stuff, and I was getting phone calls off the hook, and so when I picked up my phone and it was Alex, I knew exactly who he was. So it was kind of funny, actually, just because I would never have thought he would have called me, because I was talking more of the scouts, and then once he called me, he kind of congratulated me, and it was really cool, because I've never talked to him before, and he's a huge deal in the Toronto Blue Jays organization, so it was really cool talking to him.
Tom Robson, there was a time when you mentioned Canadian in Major League Baseball, and people would say, "Yeah, right." Now we've got a lot of Canadians in Major League Baseball, and hopefully the next one to get down there is going to be you. We wish you well. We thank you very much for your time, and good luck with Canada competing at the World Junior Playoffs. Thanks again.
All right, thanks a lot.
Toronto Blue Jay hopeful Tom Robson, right-handed pitcher, great athlete. We're going to probably hear a lot about him in the years to come. We're going to take a break. I'm David Grossman. It's Sunday morning on Sportsnet Radio, The Fan 590. Sportsnet Radio, The Fan 590. I'm David Grossman. Major League Baseball playoffs and one team moving on. The Milwaukee Brewers with Canadian George Gutaris, the 28-year-old, born in Toronto, went to school in Markham, drafted by the San Diego Padres in the 20th round, and that was 9 years ago. And now he's catching for the Brewers, and he's joining us on the phone. George, how you doing?
Dave, how you doing, brother?
You know, I really appreciate you taking the time at a very, very busy period for you and the Milwaukee Brewers. You've had a great season for the team. But how would you sum it up for George?
Thanks. Well, thanks for having me. George being here, it's been a blast. You know, my role here with the Brewers is, you know, the backup and, you know, go out there and, you know, have to occasionally pinch hit in the later innings. But, you know, it's been a crazy road. We got a great group of guys, and it's exciting to move forward.
I know there is one thing that's really at the back of your mind, and that is you were the first major leaguer to hit for the cycle this season.
Yeah.
Happened a few weeks ago against Houston, an 8-2 win for Milwaukee. Was that, I guess that must be the highlight for you of the season so far?
Yeah, so far definitely the highlight for me. You know, never really would have thought that was going to happen, you know, on that particular night or any time in that manner. And, you know, just went out there and then my last at bat kind of walked up the plate and thought, hey, all I need is a double. But, you know, I didn't really try and hit a double. It just worked out that way and it was kind of special.
Now, you're from Toronto. You went to school in Markham, Milliken Mills High School. And this was a school that didn't even have a baseball team.
No.
What went through your mind then when you had a chance to play for your school and there was no team?
Yeah, it was just one of those things where they didn't have a team, so, you know, just didn't play. And, you know, played on, you know, like the Ontario Blue Jays and that kind of sort of thing. Traveled around, traveled to the States a bunch, and kind of led me to, you know, going to junior college in Oklahoma and then being drafted by San Diego.
Now we're seeing many wonderful stories like yours, more and more Canadians playing in the majors. Do you consider that to be more of a testament or to the quality of the kind of players that are coming out of the Canadian system, or is it the coaching, or is it a combination of all of that?
It's a combination of everything. You know, you just putting yourself in the right situation, and, you know, definitely having to travel to the States, you know, is a key thing. Just kind of throwing yourself out there and playing against people that are, you know, like in California playing all year round, you know, so it's one thing where, you know, the Canadians have to try and catch up, but, you know, it's been a great work in progress.
Our guest this morning, George Gutierrez, Canadian-born, playing with the Milwaukee Brewers in the MLB playoffs. Now, you must remember this because I still have my baseball cards, one of them with Mickey Mantle, which dates how old I am.
Wow.
As a kid, though, you must have had baseball cards, but now you have your own, right? One with a picture of you on it, and it was from the Topps 2005 collection. What's it like going around knowing that you got your own baseball card?
It's kind of cool, you know, you sign autographs and you do those kind of signings and stuff like that. And it's kind of cool, you know, when you're a kid, you know, you always go to those things and, you know, ask for autographs and now, you know, handing them out, that's pretty cool and pretty neat.
Sports has been big for you, but for you it was also softball. I mean, you started that. Mm-hmm. That was through a lot of your teen years and you were what they call a latecomer to baseball, turning to the hardball game at the age of 15. What led to the switch?
Just came to the point actually till the tail end of softball, you know, there was really nowhere to head forward. And someone kind of said, hey, you know, why don't you make some calls here and see about transferring over to baseball. And it was a lot of work at first. And, you know, it's baseball is still a lot of hard work, but, you know, it definitely pays off.
Kid growing up here in Canada, do you remember hearing from a local scout about the best move for high school graduates and wanting to pursue baseball? For you, it was the junior college route in the U.S., and I think it was Connor State in Warner, Oklahoma. I can just imagine a Canadian in Warner, Oklahoma. When you look back, I assume it must have been the right move for you.
You know, it worked out well. Going from a big city in Toronto to a tiny town in Warner, Oklahoma, it was definitely a culture shock. And, you know, I had to, you know, think back and, like, really understand why I was there. And, you know, I was definitely there for baseball. And, you know, I got my education done at the same time, too. So it was, getting both done at the same time definitely was a big key for me.
And the route to success started gradually. Idaho Falls in the Pioneer League, then AAA Portland. Then you were traded to Boston. You ended up in Pawtucket. Did the up and down, that movement, ever tend to bother you as an athlete, as a person, or did you believe that all this was going to work out for the best for you?
You know, you never really know how the road's going to end up. You know, when I was with San Diego in the minor leagues, I never really thought I'd be traded, and then all of a sudden, 2006, I'm traded to the Red Sox, you know, and then 2 years playing in their minor league system in Pawtucket, and then getting called up in September of 08. So it's just, you know, it's just a crazy road, and you know, now I'm here with Milwaukee and we're making playoffs, and you know, it's a blast.
And September 08, that was your major league debut. It was in the sixth inning of a game against the Toronto Blue Jays.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, you scored the only run for the Red Sox.
I do remember. It was we were getting blown out, and you know, Tito came up to me, he's like, all right, you're going in next inning. And I was like, oh man, this is awesome. So, you know, playing the Blue Jays and making that my debut at Fenway Park was an amazing feeling.
And then the Red Sox, they turn around and they release you, claimed the same day by Milwaukee. Must have been a big surprise for you.
You know, it was one of those things where they didn't really want me to get caught up behind everybody. You know, they had Victor Martinez, Jason Varitek. You know, it was I was going to kind of get lost in the mix. And, you know, they did, you know, it was kind of best for me as well. So, you know, it worked out great for me.
George Kotaras is joining us, born in Toronto, member of the Milwaukee Brewers. And I've heard stories, I'm sure you have as well, George, from spectators talking about catchers throwing out runners, that for them, it doesn't look that hard. But in reality, it's not as easy as it looks. What's the big challenge to get that base runner wanting to test your arm?
There's a lot of things that have to happen right. You know, the pitcher has to be quick to the plate. You know, they got to be around 1.3 seconds, to, you know, from lined up to the ball hitting the catcher, and then the catcher has to turn the ball around, throw it 127 feet in under 2 seconds, you know, without going with a runner who's got tremendous speed. So everything's got to work out perfectly. It's definitely a challenge. That's why, you know, you look at statistics and they're low. They're never, you know, there's never really a success rate of over 50-60%. They're all like, you know, a really good success rate is 35%, you know. So it's a difficult thing to do. But, you know, whenever you get an opportunity to throw a runner out, you just got to do your best.
Now, you can tell people you were at the Olympic Games. You played there, but you played and chose to play for Greece, which is the country your parents are from.
Yeah.
You played first base as well. What was that experience like? And did you ever have any regrets at not playing for Canada?
You know, Greece definitely approached me first when I was younger. You know, also playing for my heritage, you know, it was an amazing feeling. And then, you know, playing in Athens and, you know, having family there and being able to speak Greek, it just, you know, was an amazing experience for me and my family.
Lots of talk about trades. That's what goes on. You're back up to Jonathan LaCroix. Does that backup role and the rumors bother you as a professional athlete?
Rumors are rumors. And, you know, sometimes there are, you know, some that become true. But, you know, at the same time, you can't really focus on that thing. You know, I've been traded and, you know, bounced around. And, you know, you kind of understand how things work. And all you can do is just control yourself.
I find some of your stats very interesting in that you do well hitting against righties. You play away from home very well. And playing during the day as well tends to be a success story for you. Does any of that surprise you?
You know, it's kind of just, those are just random statistics, nothing really, you know, based on that. You know, you look at, you know, just because I was catching Randy Wolf, you know, there was a stretch where I faced 5-6 lefties in a row. So it's kind of one of those difficult things to do. But, you know, my key thing was going out there and being out there for Randy and the team. And, you know, my offense is a bonus.
Other than maturing, learning from your fellow teammates, what's been the biggest success for you so far?
You know, you're around a different group of guys, and, you know, you learn a lot of different things from each and every person. You know, each person has their own role, I guess, and each person does the different things to prepare themselves and to succeed. So you kind of watch people go about their business and see what they do to succeed, and you kind of try and pick pieces from each person to help yourself.
During the off season, you're going to get a chance to maybe come home to Canada, talk to some of the local kids, visit your former high school?
Well, definitely the first thing I'm going to do is I need to come back and see my family. You know, it's been a while, and I have a lot of catching up to do with regards to that. And then, you know, if I do have time to make an appearance somewhere, then I'll, you know, definitely.
George Kotaras, an outstanding baseball player in his youthful days, and obviously very good, or he would be in the major leagues, had a chance to watch him perform before he made it to the pros. Could never figure out why his high school team could never put a team on the field. I don't know. It was a big sport in York region, but not at Milliken Mills in those days. Anyway, he's in the Major League playoffs, and we wish him well. The Brewers beat Arizona game 1, 4-1. Game 2 goes at Miller Park in Milwaukee, and if they continue at that pace, you never know. Could be in the World Series. Could be in the World Series. Philadelphia and Milwaukee are both up 1-0. And, of course, the Yankees are up 1-0, and Texas and Tampa Bay are tied at 1-1. So a lot of baseball still to come. And then when you look at it, as I had mentioned earlier, there are a lot of Canadians in MLB. I mean, you look at from this area alone, Joey Votto from Toronto, now doing extremely well with Cincinnati. Peter Orr, youngster out of Richmond Hill. Russell Martin from Toronto, now with the Yankees, catching. Jesse Crane. I mean, go through the complete list of Canadians in what many years ago people said, oh, no, never. Canadians will never make it. Now, the majority of them are from the West Coast because BC is a hotbed, but
I mean, John Axford, Milwaukee Brewers, had some time. He's from Simcoe, Ontario. Look at Jason Bay, just one of the many from the West Coast. And on and on. So there is hope. Ryan Dempster, another name that comes to mind with the Cubs. There is hope for a lot of these kids who have dreams and aspirations of one day making it to the major leagues. And came true for George Gutierrez. By the way, 20 years ago today, the Toronto Blue Jays clinched the American League East title. And they also became the first team to draw 4 million fans. It's been 20 years. And let's hope we don't have to wait another 20 years. Well, next week, we got a great guest joining us on Sunday morning, our Thanksgiving weekend edition. We're going to talk to a lot of athletes on what Thanksgiving means to them. And one of them is a kid who grew up on the Rock, but came to Toronto to play hockey at Upper Canada College. And he's a member of the Ottawa Senators, made the roster. Colin Greening is going to talk to us a little bit about his travels from one coast to another, because he did play in Nanaimo, BC, and then went on to Binghamton. A long route and a long road to making it to the NHL. So Colin Greening is going to join us then as we reminisce about the road to being a pro. And before we go to break, I have to mention something. I know my wife was upset about this. A lot of people are. A difficult decision by trustees on whether to close Peterborough Collegiate. I should have asked Rachel Seaman, who was on the line with us earlier. She's from Peterborough. But they decided, rather than close Thomas Stewart or Kenner or Adam Scott, there's only room for so many schools in Peterborough. They decided to put the lock on Peterborough Collegiate, the oldest school. Now, what does an old school like that mean to the community? I'm just going to tell you, Jim Balsillie, the chairman and CEO of Research in Motion, went to that school. They've turned out some great, great people. Craig Ramsey, who was involved with the Atlanta Thrashers before they moved north to Winnipeg. He's a graduate of that school. Peter Demos, who's a professor at MIT, a nuclear physicist, served as a science advisor to President John F. Kennedy. I mean, the list goes on. Serena Ryder, Juno Award winner, singer, songwriter, all graduates of PCVS, the oldest school in Peterborough. And now somebody's decided they're going to put a lock on it, shut the school down, probably tear it down, sell it. Who knows? But it's very disappointing in the educational system. And then they got to shove all the kids out to other schools, let alone the staff as well. So I hope when politicians make decisions that are in the best interest of the community and the taxpayer, they make wise ones. But it still is disappointing to see a school with such tremendous history close up. And that's exactly what Peterborough Collegiate Vocational Secondary has in the minds of many people. Very, very disappointing. When we come back, Dave Haxtell is going to join us, the head coach of the University of North Dakota men's hockey team. Why? Well, he'll tell us a little bit about Matt Fratton, the rookie who's going to make the Toronto Maple Leafs for the opener coming up this week. My name is David Grossman. It's Sunday morning on Sportsnet Radio, The Fan 590. Minutes before 9 o'clock. 10 o'clock. Boy, does time fly in this business. I'm David Grossman, Sportsnet Radio, The Fan 590. Just enjoying the music. Dan Riccio doing a fabulous job. Director of Technical Operations, Igor Enriquez, producer of this show. And Thursday is a big day in sports. Thursday. And I don't mean the Ontario election. Les Canadiens of Montreal coming to Toronto to play our Maple Leafs in the season opener for both of them. One player really looking forward to this is, I'm sure, a rookie by the name of Matt Fratton. And someone who knows this youngster as a player and a student of the game, and probably just as just a genuine individual, likely more too, is his former head coach at the University of North Dakota. Dave Haxtell is kind enough to join us this morning. And I would imagine that Fratton is probably going to get a chance with a Kadri out of the lineup for at least a month with a torn knee ligament. Then again, maybe Fratton's just impressed management enough to get a start. But anyway, we'll find out more about it. Good morning, Coach. How are you?
Very well, David. How are you this morning?
Very well, thank you. We appreciate your time. Matt Fratton making the Toronto Maple Leafs. Does that surprise you?
Well, I know how big of a step and how tough of a thing that is to do as a rookie coming in. But I have to say it. No, it does not. Doesn't surprise me. I mean, we've had some pretty good players come through and step into the National Hockey League and have success. And Matt is as ready as any of those players.
Now, as a coach, you work with these youngsters. They're prodigies of club systems, of schools. They're young. They come into university. You've got to develop them, take them to that next level. They're there, obviously, for an education, but also to fulfill some dreams as athletes as well. What was your first opinion when you saw Fratton, when he stepped on the ice at the University of North Dakota's Ralph Engelstad Arena? What was it that really impressed you, or something that said, oh, this kid needs some work?
Well, my guess is probably the same things that we saw when he played in the Alberta Junior Hockey League and when he was here with us as a rookie are some of the same things that you're seeing there in Toronto. He needs some development to his game, we thought. He needs to improve in a lot of areas, but he's so versatile. He can play a physical game. He can score. He can make some plays. He skates and works hard two directions. All of those little things we saw in him. He just needed maturity to his game at that time.
Remember his freshman year playing defense at the University of North Dakota?
He's played a little bit of everything here. He's done a pretty good job. But he had holes in his game. As a guy, as a young forward at that point in time, you try to instill in these guys how important it is, the little areas of the game, taking care of the puck, not turning the puck over in critical areas. And those are things that, I think Matt really began to understand through his early time here.
He's a 23-year-old, and there are a lot of people who say these kids need to spend some time, work their way up. Others say, no, if they're ready, put them right into the pros. Can he handle the big league spotlight right now, in your opinion?
Oh, I think he has to prove that now over time. I think he's prepared to handle it. As I said, I think physically he's, one of the most ready guys. We've had a lot of players, guys like Travis Zajac, Taves, Oshie, these guys that have stepped right from our program into the National Hockey League and have been ready to build careers in the NHL without spending time in the American Hockey League. I think Matt is one of the guys that can do that. As I said, I think he's versatile enough. If there's not room for him to be a guy in that top six type of role, I think he's mature enough to know what he has to do as a third line, as a fourth line winger. And I think that gives him a chance to build his game right away at the NHL level.
Joining us, Dave Haxtell, who's the head coach of the University of North Dakota men's hockey team, and someone who has seen Matt Fratton, the Leafs forward, develop and mature as a hockey player and as an individual. And like everyone, Coach, I have yet to meet somebody who hasn't made a mistake somewhere in their lives. Matt did. He made several, like the summer of 2009. He was arrested that year in the summer, pleaded guilty to disorderly conduct, and then things got worse. A few weeks later, he was arrested for driving under the influence of alcohol, a charge that he would later beat. But for him, it cost him a lot, including a scholarship. And after these two alcohol-related incidents, one of them, as I mentioned, he was acquitted of. Fratton was once dismissed from the team. I mean, some guys give up. They just throw their hands in the air, see that's it. They look for something else. He didn't. And I think, if I remember correctly, words that you've associated with Matt are commitment and selflessness and teamwork. What was it, in your opinion, that gained the respect back for a kid like him?
Well, I think it was his overall reaction to the situation. I think we tend to live in a world now where not a lot of situations do we come upon, it seems, where guys actually look in the mirror and say, no, I got to take ownership of this. I've got to make some changes. I'm a little bit off track here, and I've got to make some adjustments. And that through that whole time period, I think that's the number one thing that stands out. There was never any finger pointing. There was no poor me. Matt, probably even overly so, took full responsibility for everything. He went back home with his family and readjusted his sights, decided what he wanted to do. From my standpoint, We had and Matt had, you know, great support from Toronto, from Brian on down. You know, Dallas Eakins had built a relationship with Matt. Jim Hughes was just coming on board and did a good job in building him through that time. But most of the most of the credit goes to back to Matt and his family. And I mean, he's a character kid. He made a couple of adjustments and decided what direction he wanted to go in his life. And here we are 2 years later, he's competing for a job in the National Hockey League.
Big word is maturity, and you're right. Here he is, a professional athlete. How did you feel, though, as a coach, though, calling him in and saying, I got to cut you from the team?
Hardest meeting I've ever had. And, it stems from a lot of things. But Matt, if you've met him and talked with him, it's impossible not to like Matt. He's a tremendous guy. Along with that, he was one of our top six forwards, maybe our top right winger, going into a year where we had pretty high expectations. But I guess at the end of the day, you have to look back and try to make decisions based on what you think is right. And it was a pretty drastic decision and a drastic move, but it was something that I felt needed to happen. Thank goodness, Matt and his family, reacted the way they did. Not an easy thing to do, and they did a great job with it, and just tremendous amount of credit goes to both Matt and his parents.
Even adults get a little nervous when they're ready to go to the podium. They're recipient of an award or a finalist or something like that. In the case of Matt Fratton, he was a top university hockey player in the United States. He was a Hobie Baker. He was considered to be one of the elite of the elite. Do you think something like that tends to get on the mind of a youngster? I mean, tends to take him away from his mission, which is to perform on the ice?
Well, I think it can. I've seen it happen in the past, but I didn't see it happen with Fratty. I thought Matt stayed right on target. I don't think it distracted him. You know, even our final game of the year, which was it was a devastating loss, for a team that had been on a mission throughout the year. Matt didn't score, but he played well. He played hard. He had all kinds of scoring opportunities. It was just one of those nights where, the puck wasn't going to go in the net for him. So I don't think it distracted him. I think, through some of the experiences he had gone through, he's able to filter through the things that are important, and he's able to focus on the exact job at hand at that moment. And I think that's a real strength of him.
There are some athletes who think they know everything, and there are some who are a little embarrassed to ask questions when they know they need answers to become better players. Were there times where he called you aside and said, hey, coach, let's have a little chat. Let's shut the door. Let's go have a pop or something. I need your advice.
Matt's not the kind of guy that does a whole lot of that. He's more a guy that internalizes things, especially early on in his career. And I think that was one of the real maturity signs that we saw in him in his last year and a half here with us. He was much more comfortable, on a hockey level, on a regular life level, of just sitting down and talking. And I think he had a great comfort level and a great confidence level. And I think we're seeing more and more of that in him. And that's maturity. It's learning to become a pro and being ready to be a pro when you actually take that step.
University of North Dakota men's hockey coach Dave Haxtell joining us in discussion with Matt Fratton, a member of the Toronto Maple Leaf hockey team. He can block shots, we know that, and we know he can finish checks, and we know he can score. But is there something that he still needs a lot of work on, coach?
Well, again, I'll go back just to the overall maturity of his game. I think, he has to find a role at the National Hockey League level, and that may or may not be in a role where he's expected to score. He's going to have to make sure that he has a great baseline to his game, which, I think he's done a good job in improving, and that's going to give him a chance. But so, from my standpoint, he's got a lot of different abilities, very versatile. He's just really got to focus on the opportunity that's put in front of him, and whatever role is asked of him, I know this, he's willing to go out and play that role to the best of his ability. He just needs to continue maturing his game. And obviously that's a whole new level for him. But like I said, to start out with, he's one of the guys that's ready to go there and compete to be a National Hockey League player. And quite honestly, I think he's ready to go there and produce. Obviously, the regular season is a little bit different level than the preseason. But hopefully he can take what he's done in the preseason. He's done a good job there. Hopefully he can take that now and springboard it into a good start to his regular season.
Just picking up on what you're saying there, some people see Fratton as a playmaker, and others see him as the guy that puts the puck in the net. Some have difficulty seeing him as a guy in a corner, a scrapper. Can he do them all?
He can do all. I mean, I don't... You know, he's not, I don't know that he's a high-end playmaker. I think Matt creates with his speed and his power. He's an extremely powerful player on the ice. His lower body strength, his jump out of the gates in terms of his first couple strides are excellent. So he's going to create with his speed and with his strength. He's got a real quick release. I think he's got an NHL shot, an NHL release. So he's got to use those things to his advantage. And he's strong enough and tenacious enough to win puck battles down low, which, again, is a big part of the game. Puck possession, coming up with 50-50 pucks. I think Matt can become very efficient at that at the NHL level.
Is he also dangerous off the rush?
Well, he is because of his speed. I think one of the things he does well is he anticipates turnovers well, and that, you know, that helps him in transition because he can anticipate a turnover and, you know, one or two steps. He can get a bit of an advantage, or at least put a defenseman in an uncomfortable position. So I think I think in that way, with his speed, with his anticipation, if he gets a half step on a guy, he's a guy that can take the puck to the net.
What's the chatter like at the University of North Dakota, knowing that one of your own has made it to the National Hockey League?
Well, I think, you know, guys are excited for him. We're proud of, you know, all our guys. I think we had 20-some guys at NHL camps. It looks like we'll have about 20 guys in the National Hockey League. A couple of Matt's teammates from last year, Brad Malone, is still with the Avalanche. Jason Gregoire is still with the Winnipeg Jets. So, you know, those three guys as rookies are challenging to stay in the National Hockey League, and we're proud of them. You know, we want them to come here. We want them to do well here. We want them to grow up and become men and become ready to be pro athletes, and I think Matt's the epitome of that.
You've obviously contributed to his success. Maybe he'll send you a couple of tickets to a game.
Well, I'd love to get up there. I'd love to come up and see the home opener next Thursday. Unfortunately, we'll be busy with our own things here, but we'll be watching him on TV for sure and taking a lot of pride in his progress there.
Dave Haxtell, we appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on, David. I appreciate it.
Head coach of the University of North Dakota men's hockey team and a guy who knows the sport and also Leaf prospect Matt Fratton extremely well. And see what happens. League opener Thursday against the Canadiens. I want to thank our guests for joining us this morning. John Winfield, University of Toronto mountain biker. Allison Little, field hockey. The University of Guelph. She's going to be a vet. I don't know how she's going to do that. With rats as her pets. Mike Benavides, defensive coordinator, university. Well, he did some great university work as well, but with the BC Lions. Rachel Seaman, the Canadian race walk champion. Tom Robson, Canadian baseball player. George Gutierrez, now in the Major League Baseball playoffs. And, of course, Dave Haxtell. And quarterback Shane Kelly with Wilfred Laurier, producer of the show. Igor Enriquez. Fabulous job. Dan Riccio as well, Director of Technical Operations. We're going to see you next Sunday morning, our Thanksgiving edition. I'm David Grossman. Have a great day and a great weekend. This is Sportsnet Radio, The Fan 590.